Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, Sophie McIntosh talks about her latest novel, Blue Ticket. Sophie McIntosh is the author of The Water Cure, which was long listed for the Man Booker Prize in 2018 and won a Betty Trask Award in 2019. And she has also won the White Review Short Story Prize and the Virago Stylist Short Story Competition and has been published in Granta, The White Review and Tank Magazine, among others. And today we're going to be talking about Blue Ticket, which is Sophie's latest novel. Sophie, welcome back to Little Atoms.
Hi, Neil.
So how would you describe Blue Ticket for us, first of all?
So I would kind of describe it personally as almost like a psychedelic road trip. Like, it's kind of a bit speculative, a bit dystopian, but it follows a woman, Calla, who's pregnant as she basically tries to, I guess, wrestle with the control of her life. So Calla has been assigned a blue ticket. When you are in this world that the book is set in, women are sent to a lottery station in adolescence and they have to pick a ticket, a white ticket or a blue ticket. A white ticket means you can have a family and a blue ticket means you can't. So Calla has picked a blue ticket and is kind of happy with her lot, but then at some point things start changing for her and she starts to question her ticket and she gets pregnant and goes on the run.
And you say a bit dystopian and a bit speculative, and I remember when we talked about The Water Cure, we talked about the style of that book, and Blue Ticket follows a similar thing in that you don't spend a whole lot of time world building this place. You present this situation, this is the situation, straight in there, we're off. There's no, this is the place, this is how this happened, things got gradually worse, then they ended up in this situation, here we are now. It's just, this is the situation, and we're off. And I think, first of all, I love that. I love the fact that it's just, deal with it, this is the situation, get on with it. But also, I think in a lot of ways, there's various ways in which the Calla herself and the other women in this book are ignorant of their own situations. And so that sort of seems to be reflected in the style of the book as well.
Yeah, definitely. Like, she doesn't know anything about pregnancy. She doesn't know anything about what it's going to do to her body, which is quite a scary idea. But yeah, I really like borrowing things, I think, from speculative and dystopian fiction. Like, my priority is like not creating a dystopian world that is very fleshed out. My priority is kind of not the dystopia, I guess. Mine is more, I've got this idea and I've got the story and the character, and how can I best kind of, I guess, show this character's journey? What can I borrow from any genre? Like, what can I borrow from film? What can I borrow from art? What can I borrow from dystopia? I love the freedom of just being able to create a world which is completely your own, and you can take whatever you need from anywhere. And, you know, I think that's, you know, it's part of the joy of writing, is that you can actually do that. And so I think just ambiguity is a very good space to be doing that and to be leaving those gaps and to be throwing people right in it without necessarily explaining so much.
So what other things in particular might have been an influence on this story?
I think definitely it feels very filmic. When I was writing it, it felt filmic. I was listening to a lot of music and like a very specific kind of soundtrack that I'd made for the book. And I had like a whole mood board about kind of images that I had taken from films, like road trip movies, but also I think one film that was a really big like visual influence for me was Morven Calla, the film adaptation, because there's hotels and landscapes. I also like, I think because when The Water Girl came out, I was lucky enough to travel a lot and got to stay in a lot of hotels in that year. And I really love hotels, and I love service stations. Like, you could probably put me in the most rubbish hotel in the world and I would have a lovely time, because it's just something about the, I guess, like the in-betweenness of it. You're in a room and you're by yourself and you've got all these tiny little shampoos and stuff, and you can kind of do what you like. And I think, like, you don't really get to do that anywhere else but in a hotel. So kind of, I guess, using all these things I was thinking about and experiencing, just sort of squishing them into a vaguely speculative book.
And I don't know if I'm projecting this as well, but I also thought with the sort of style of the book, as I said, seems even more pared down than the Water Cure did. It's written in little paragraphs with spaces in between them, and is often sort of very, again, we don't have that much of a grasp on the outside world. It's often very dreamlike, and in fact Keller often talks about that. And I wondered also, as it goes on, whether or not it's representing the, I guess, the state of pregnancy in some ways as well. The fact that a person's body is sort of changed, their sort of hormones change their body out of their control as well.
Yeah, I think definitely, for sure. And one thing that I really like in a book is having a kind of time structure. I think if I don't have a specific structure, it can kind of, I can get a bit lost. But actually, like, it's great. It has a built-in structure because, you know, she's got 9 months. And so she has to, like, you know, the story has to be 9 months long, and that kind of short paragraph, yeah, like the short paragraph, the usage of short paragraphs for me was both kind of, I guess, yeah, representing her kind of physical reality, but also she's quite like a fragmented person, and it's quite a, I guess it's quite a difficult experience as she's going through, and it's almost like only what's necessary is kept in, if that makes sense, because she's kind of, she has to be super focused. So in a way, it's almost like she's kind of, it's just about what she's experiencing in those moments, and the rest is kind of superfluous and we don't need to know about it.
How did that come together in the writing then? So did you have a much more detailed version that you sort of stripped down?
I'm not sure if it ever got that much more detailed. I'm kind of I kind of like to fill things out more than strip them down, but I do a lot of drafts, like loads and loads. And I do think, looking at my document where I kind of put all the bits that I've cut out, I think I did strip easily probably 20,000 words from the draft. I think I like to have the extra words as the kind of the backstory that I know about personally, and that will kind of give me the ability to fill in, to leave those gaps. So I kind of know what's happening, but then I don't think it's necessary to the story, I guess.
Let's talk more about Calla then. Tell us something more about who she is.
So she's quite tough and quite cold. I guess the main thing in the context of the book that people comment on is, like, she does not seem very maternal. And I mean, that's a key element of the book, is that she would kind of be probably the person you'd meet in a bar who'd be a bit drunk, and you'd probably think she didn't like you because she'd be quite aloof. And, you know, she's very absorbed in the idea of herself as a self-contained entity and someone who doesn't need anyone. So to actually then be experiencing, I think, this kind of physical want, which she didn't expect when she kind of starts wanting to have a child. And then, you know, all of that brings about all the changes that are very out of your control and unpredictable. It's quite a hard thing for her character.
And she puts that on herself as well, because she constantly has this idea that her situation, she is somehow bad, and she is being judged fundamentally, that, you know, she's been judged to be not maternal, which is why she got the blue ticket. But then almost constantly she feels she's being observed and judged. And I guess that's one of the things that, you know, the concept of, you know, just women constantly being judged whatever they do is one of the ways in which this reflects back to women's experience in the real world.
Yeah, definitely. Like, she is kind of watched and judged. But something as well as that I was interested in exploring was the ways in which we self-police ourselves as well. And, you know, she's been told her entire life she is a blue ticket, she's not maternal, and it's something that's not for her. It's been reinforced constantly and has almost kind of led her, I guess, into a different kind of life. And I was interested in that idea of how we kind of internalize these ideas about ourselves, as well as getting those ideas from external forces. And obviously, I mean, kind of works both ways. If you are being judged constantly, then you will kind of internalize it more. But there's so much self-policing in the book, I think, and like, you know, everyone's kind of pitted against each other a bit, and that's almost the scariest thing in the world, especially in a dystopian context, because it's not just as simple as, like, oh, the baddies are out to get us. It's like, what if the baddies kind of inside you, and it's also all around?
It does have that sort of feel of, you know, what people imagine it must have been like to be in, like, East Germany or something, you know, in the Cold War, where nobody can trust anybody else. And the situation itself has poisoned, even for the people that might... I mean, to be fair, you never really make this judgment, but, you know, some people might think that the white tickets are the ones that have won this lottery. But at the same time, you know, their relationship, the relationship between husbands and wives on that side, is also poisoned by, like, every relationship that happens in this book seems to be sort of like poisoned by this outside situation.
Yeah, it's kind of, it's hard because in this world, like, how many people, or in the world of the book, how many people kind of get what they're assigned and what they really want kind of lining up, I guess. And when there is so much on the kind of their roles and there is so much kind of hanging on it, it's just, yeah, it all feels a bit sort of transactional and unreal and not very, none of it feels very, very happy, I guess.
I leapt right in there and said that, you know, the people with the white tickets are the ones that, you know, might be perceived as to have got the better deal. You know, that's really not the case. And what I find interesting in the lives of the blue ticket women is the illusion of freedom, I guess what it is. There's no choice. Like, the people don't have choice. But the blue ticket women are given this idea of, like, total, almost total freedom. And in fact, you know, we could say that the women who are blue tickets, you know, get to behave in ways in terms of their sexual autonomy, for instance, that women are not granted in the world that we live in. And yet, you know, the sort of the key theme of the book here seems to be that, you know, this idea of choice is an illusion.
Yeah, definitely. Just, yeah, that idea of, again, I think it comes back to the self-policing thing again, where it's like, is Calla, like, actually making decisions based on her own want, or has she got these ideas from somewhere else? Even in terms when it comes to the baby, like, she kind of feels like she's making a choice, but is she making that choice just because she wants to make a choice and it's something that's kind of not open to her? I always think it would have been interesting to kind of explore a blue ticket woman who's a bit more happy with her life, but also maybe uses her life more for good in a way that Calla doesn't. Not that Calla doesn't, but you know someone who's like has excelled in their career or something and is actually very happy with the idea of not having a child. And because it's not as simple as like, oh, you're either a mother or you're like a chain smoking heavy drinking renegade. Really, it's totally not that simple. But I think for the idea of the book, it was kind of to keep things manageable, I guess.
I mean, I enjoyed the way that was sort of carried on even after she becomes pregnant, that there is, like, you know, lots of scenes of smoking and drinking. Again, we've already discussed that, you know, these women don't necessarily know anything about any of the information about childbirth, about pregnancy, about what's good and bad. But it was sort of like quite shocking and transgressive to see the amount of smoking and drinking that she carried on.
Yeah, I mean, like, she literally doesn't, I mean, she kind of knows, but I don't think she knows, like, she kind of was told, like, once from a leaflet. But I think it's part of me just, you know, even writing it, I was like, oh, I feel like I'm getting a bit of a reaction, you know, making a pregnant woman down a whiskey. Like, it's kind of, it's really not acceptable, but it kind of makes you think about, there really are, like, quite some taboos around that stuff. We do expect a lot from mothers, and there is a lot of judgment in that, even fictionally. And I know readers have had, like, quite visceral reactions to that. And even though it's like, it's literally made up, it's strange how kind of entrenched in us, like, it is, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it is amazing how sort of how society polices women during pregnancy in that way, because I can think of, you know, occasions where you might be in the street and see a pregnant woman smoking, and it is a shock. It is like a shocking sight, and you do go.
Yeah, I remember in I was watching Catastrophe, and it's got Sharon Horgan, Rob Delaney, and I think it's the only TV show maybe where I've seen like a woman drinking. Like, she wasn't drinking a lot. I think she occasionally has like a glass of red wine, and it's a stressful situation. And I think you are allowed to have like a glass of red wine, but I was kind of interested how I'd never actually seen a pregnant woman drinking in a TV show before, and it did feel like quite like transgressive even to see her having this tiny little bit of wine.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Sophie McIntosh. We're talking about her latest novel, Blue Ticket. And Sophie, we've already talked about how there is minimal world building in the setup of the story, and you outline the idea of the ticket. So this is a woman is either given a blue ticket or a white ticket, and therefore she can have children or not have children. But there are ways in which you do expand on their lives in this world. One of the ways I wanted to talk about, which is left, it is left very mysterious, often for deliberate reasons, because Callum might not necessarily want to recall it. But let's talk about this idea that the women after the lottery, because they're girls, it's, you know, when they first hit puberty, that this lottery happens, they are basically then abandoned to fend for themselves and are given like the most cursory equipment for their journey to the city. What happens?
So I guess, like the lottery, I'm kind of very interested in the idea of ritual and kind of ritualizing experiences that are, you know, kind of not universal experiences, but experiences of adulthood and growing up. And I guess like Carla being sent away in the book is kind of a ritual, and the lottery is a ritual, and then this journey into the city is another kind of ritual. And I guess it was kind of a slightly maybe heavy-handed metaphor for, you know, the idea of making it to adulthood, but there's a difference in the way that the blue ticket women and the white ticket women make this journey. It is more dangerous for the blue ticket women, and I think, you know, it was mainly kind of me trying to physically conceptualize a very like nebulous but real feeling, yeah, and to make it real in this strange ritualized world.
And this is a world again where on the one hand women do have seemingly more autonomy, certainly around their sexuality and their ability to express that, but it is also, you know, it's a world of omnipresent, as is a world of omnipresent male violence. And I wanted to talk about writing about that. It's a patriarchal society. The whole overriding scheme here is very, very clearly a patriarchal society. But also on the journey to the city, there are predatory men. And all through, especially once Keller again leaves the safety, the perceived safety of the city in the hotels and service stations along the way, there's always this sort of omnipresent danger of violent men.
I think, it's something that kind of came up in The Water Cure as well. And I guess it's not that, you know, it's not like I think all men are terribly violent or anything, but like you said, we kind of do live in a patriarchy. And so I kind of always end up writing these things which do involve kind of male violence, because I guess it's just kind of, I know realistically that's out there for these girls. Like if they're on the road making this journey, if they're kind of in this futuristic world which is a bit dog eat dog and does kind of divide women into categories based on these nebulous features which we don't really know about, based on like what kind of woman they are and what that means for their worth, and you know what that means for the men's ability to have a family as well, it just kind of fit for me, because it's not like we can't pretend that male violence doesn't exist. And I think, yeah, maybe it's more explicit in this world, but only because everything is a bit more stark in this world as well, I think.
In writing the book, did you do research into pregnancy? Did you talk to pregnant women or women with children?
Yeah, I did loads. I don't have a baby myself, but I've got lots of friends who've been having babies. I did do a lot of research into pregnancy. I mean, I'm kind of fascinated by it anyway. It wasn't really even like sort of I'm doing research for my book. It was like I'm researching for my own needs. Yeah, maybe things like watching a natural cesarean video on YouTube wasn't strictly necessary, and I don't know if I would do that again. Yeah, like talking to friends and family about it was really important, and you know, it was important for me to kind of work out my own feelings as well. And it was almost like it kind of fed into both the book and my feelings, because you know, the more I thought about pregnancy and the more it became like less of an abstract idea and more of a thing in my life, the more I wanted to talk about it, and then the more I was thinking about it, and then the more it kind of fed into the book.
Just one more thing for me, and then I'll get you to read a bit of Blue Ticket if you would. What's next? What are you working on next? Is there anything you can tell us about?
I'm working on a historical novel at the moment. I'm just kind of taking it slow. But yeah, it's quite different to anything I've written before, but I still think it has the bits that I find fun about, like borrowing from speculative and dystopian fiction, which is that, you know, if you borrow from historical fiction as well, you can still make things up. It's just maybe there's like the less of the expectation that you're kind of predicting the future or like trying to fix a problem or making some massive statement on society. It's like, nope, I'm just writing about something that actually happened, but I'm doing it in my own little way. So we'll see. So I'm going to read a bit from the lottery station scene where they pick their ticket. The floorboards were wooden, varnished aggressively. countless feet had scuffed that floor. It pooled the reflections of all the lights, spotlights from the ceiling, a lamp on the desk where a man in a dark suit sat on an orange plastic chair, watching us, legs crossed. He could have been a doctor, but he wore no white coat, no white plastic gloves. There were four other girls in their own dresses sitting on a row on a wooden bench, flowers both real and fake pinned to chests. They were not the girls from my school. One wore velvet, two wore tulle, and the other wore satin like me. We lined up, waiting to pull our tickets from the machine, the way you would take your number at the butcher's counter. The music popular that year played from speakers on the ceiling. Just gravity enough, just ceremony enough, not necessarily such an important thing, after all. My name was called first. They watched me as I walked the length of the room, towards the machine inside its cloaked box. I put my hand in it. I was apprehensive, but ready for my life to be decided. I closed my eyes and thought about my father with the wine bottle to his eye. The machine was silent as it discharged a sliver of hard paper into my hand. It was a deep cobalt. "Congratulations," the possible doctor in the dark suit said to me. The other girls followed, each taking their own ticket from the machine in turn. "Almost a full house," he exclaimed at the end, reading a piece of paper spat out from the machine. We huddled and compared tickets. They were all blue, except for one, which was white. The girl with the white ticket was escorted into a separate room by the doctor and another emissary. We watched the three of them walk through an unlit doorway. When the doctor came back, he clapped his hands twice. "You have been spared," he said, with a terrible benevolence. At the desk, the emissary who had been on the door wrote down the results to communicate to homes, to clinics, to places distant and important that we did not know about. One by one, we were called into another room, a different room to the girl who had pulled the white ticket. I lay on a reclining chair with a crisp paper cover, and another doctor, this one a woman and comforting almost, in the familiar white coat, told me to fold up my knees. She pushed something inside me that hurt, a sharp and spidering pain. "What is it?" I asked, and she said, "Your doctor will explain it all when you get to wherever you're going." She said when and not if, and I was grateful for that. The bathroom of the lottery house was filled with yellow light, the veins of my thin neck standing out underneath it. I was a plucked chicken with badly applied eyeshadow, but the locket was around my throat now. There was a long, low mirror above the sink, a wicker chair in the corner, and two bathroom stalls painted peach. In the mirror, I watched the other girls leaning against the wall, toes flexing, eyes raised to the ceiling, moving to the door when the girl with the white ticket came in to join us, then back at the ceiling. There was a dying flower arrangement at the corner of the sink, gaps of oasis showing through pink carnations. The music came through in here too, speakers in the ceiling or underneath the sink. At first, I kept looking at the girl who had drawn the white ticket, the other girl in satin, though hers was pale blue and dirty at the hem where it dragged. Her eyes were red. I had the urge to take her arm and run with her somewhere, out to the woodland where I used to smoke with the other girls my age between lessons, beyond the broken barbed wire of the school perimeter where the teachers could not see us. But I did not touch her. I made myself stop looking. Inside the cubicle, I spent some time reading the names and dates scratched on the door. With the safety pin that held on my fake peony corsage, I engraved Kala, blue ticket, a smiley face, and the date underneath. The swell of relief, smooth and natural as a muscle. I would never have children, and I was glad. I had been a child myself not so long ago. I did not want to put any puny creature through that. I went with the rest of the girls back to the lottery room, where our parents stood lined up. There was a table with pots of tea and coffee, biscuits and thin sandwiches on china plates, packets of tissues. The doctor who had supervised the whole thing stood in front of the parents, as if we had interrupted them mid-address. Maybe we had. The mothers smiled. The fathers looked grim. An emissary handed us each a bottle of water, a compass and a sandwich from the table, wrapped in a napkin. We did not get to pick the filling. The bottle given to the white ticket girl was larger than ours, I noticed, and she received two sandwiches. It was happening immediately, the diverging of our paths, no time to spare. "Go," the doctor said to us, "to the place of your choice. Walk into it, anywhere but here. Congratulations." I met my father's gaze. I had a city in mind. He looked back at me and nodded his head. We walked out together into the cool night. The adults stayed in the light for coffee and refreshments to debrief with the doctor. We might see our parents again. We might not. Some of the girls halted at once when we got outside. They didn't know where to go. New and bewildered as the fawns I saw at the edges of the trees in the dusk. The girl with the white ticket, though, She walked directly into the woods, the lights of our torches bouncing off the satin until she was gone into the dark. We were not so different. I put the compass in the palm of my hand. North or south, east or west. The flicker of the needle, the splintered light of the moon on its glass casing. I knew I could do this, could prove myself something beyond chewed up cuticles and the mold smell of the bathroom and boys in the dark, fumbling for something I was willing to give but barely had. My life was out there, ahead of me. I had to run to it, now that the shape of it was cast. Some of the girls followed me as I set off down the pale stretch of road. I listened to the pad of their feet behind me, unwilling to let them come closer. One of the girls was crying for her mother, but her mother would not come. Nobody would come.
So I've been talking to Sophie McIntosh. We've been talking about her latest novel, Blue Ticket, which is out now in the UK from Hamish Hamilton. Sophie, thank you so much for taking the time to share it with us.
Thank you for having me, Neil.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, edited by Sky Redman, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.